They're not interested in what we have to say or our contributions to the budget process.
A proposal to tap the permanent fund and leave state savings in place further divides House members. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, should foster kids be notified before the state takes their federal benefits?
It seems like you're trying to take money from a child.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Most Alaskans who offered public testimony Wednesday on a proposed overhaul of the state's oil and gas taxes and tax credits opposed the measure. Fairbanks resident Cynthia Henry urged House Resources Committee members to vote against House Bill 111. The bill would lower oil and gas tax credits and increase minimum production taxes.
It would be a big mistake to raise oil taxes. I'm certain that the results would be less investment, less production, fewer jobs, and a deepening recession.
Many of those who oppose the bill cite personal experiences or the experiences of family members working for the oil and gas industry. Nanilchik resident Jack Kuznikoff says he has personal experience of the potential change.
When oil companies are profitable, you know, there's more jobs. There's more people working, and I strongly oppose HB 111.
Nearly three-quarters of the people who testified opposed the bill, some even saying that it doesn't go far enough in eliminating tax credits. But Skagway resident Robin Sulfinsberg supports the bill. She says changing oil taxes should be the legislature's first option as it works to balance the state's budget.
I encourage you to stand for Alaska and not for oil. Our schools, public safety, and dividends are equally, if not more, important as tax subsidies.
The House Resources Committee will hear more public testimony at a future meeting. For years, the minority caucus in the House, Alaska House, has had a say in the state's budget, but that may not happen this year as the majority caucus looks to tap permanent fund earnings to close the budget gap. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
House minority members say they're being cut out of the budget process. Here's House Minority Leader Charisse Millett of Anchorage.
They're not interested in what we have to say or our contributions to the budget process.
To understand why the minority feels left out, it pays to understand what the state government's two large piggy banks are and what it takes to spend from them. One account is the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The state constitution requires three-quarters of each house of the legislature to vote to spend money from the reserve. That's given the House minority leverage in past years, since it became impossible to balance the budget without this money. The other piggy bank is the permanent fund earnings. For the past 35 years, the state has only spent money from fund earnings for permanent fund dividends. But if the legislature wanted to, it could spend these earnings by a simple majority vote. That's what Representative Paul Seaton wants to do. The majority caucus Republican from Homer has proposed drawing more than $4 billion from the earnings reserve to pay to close the budget gap. Some of the money would go to the state's education fund.
We really want to work on the major thing that Alaskans want us to work on, which is the comprehensive sustainable fiscal plan. And as long as we have a unfunded budget, we will be working on that for a long time. So we fully fund the budget by having that education fund.
Anchorage Minority Caucus Republican Lance Pruitt says the Senate will have the House minorities back.
I'm going to go back a ways, go back to high school. I had friends. And sometimes if you forget that people have friends and you mess with someone, then it comes back later and it really hurts. And we got friends over on the Senate. There's a whole other body that this has got to go through.
Pruitt says Seaton is manipulating the entire House majority by suggesting the budget change. Seaton is the House Finance Committee co-chairman and proposed the change as the chairman of the committee's budget language subcommittee.
To try to hide something like that, that's deceptive. That's just flat out deceptive. But that being said, the whole caucus is resting on that one person.
For his part, Seaton says past Finance Committee chairmen included changes to the budget language without any committee votes. On Tuesday, the committee did vote on Seaton's proposal to draw from permanent fund earnings. It passed 7-4 along caucus lines.
Every single amendment was offered and voted on by full finance, so there were no balls hidden.
2 years ago, the two caucuses were in opposite positions. The Republicans were then in the majority and wanted to shift permanent fund earnings in a way that would have allowed them to bypass minority support for drawing from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And most Democrats opposed the move, but they're now in the majority that could bypass the minority. Both sides distinguished their position 2 years ago from where they are now. Republicans say they only raised the idea of bypassing the minority 2 years ago because they wanted to avoid pink slips for state workers after months of budget negotiations. And those who were in the minority then note the proposal 2 years ago would have drained state savings by a larger amount than the current majority is considering. For the earnings draw to be adopted, it would require another vote by the House Finance Committee, then votes by the full House and the Senate. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Some foster kids are eligible to receive Social Security benefits, but the kids and their families don't always know the money is available. Instead, the state applies for the benefits and puts the funds toward paying for foster care services. Now, a lawsuit is asking if the state needs to notify families and guardians before it starts taking the money. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
About 160 foster kids in Alaska are entitled to Social Security benefits because they have a disability or one of their parents has died. But most of the time, the money doesn't go to the individual child. It goes straight to the state.
See, what smells bad about this is the state seems to be trying to gain federal money that it isn't necessarily entitled to. That's what smells bad.
That's Superior Court Judge William Morse, who heard oral arguments in the case in late February.
It seems like you're trying to take money from a child.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it is legal for state agencies to receive federal benefits on behalf of foster children and use the money to pay for the kids' care while they're in custody. The question is, can they legally do it in Alaska without providing any notice? If a child's guardian ad litem or attorney knew the child could get between $700 and $2,000 per month in federal benefits, they could try to find a relative or another person to be a private payee. Then, the money wouldn't go toward the care the child is already entitled to from the state. Attorney Jim Davis, who's arguing the case on behalf of foster children, says that instead,
you could be using these money, these Social Security monies, for tutoring, for therapy, to do the things in life that your kids probably do and my kids probably go to the state fair, go to Alyeska, have an iPhone.
Or in some cases, the money could be set aside for when the kid ages out of foster care. Assistant Attorney General Leah Farzine argued on behalf of the state. She says the state is not required to notify anyone about the potential benefits, and providing notice would be a burden.
We're opposed because there's no obligation to do so, and the state is not doing anything wrong. And therefore, the state being ordered to do something to correct a problem that doesn't exist is unfair.
To who?
To the state.
It's unfair to you to have to add a paragraph in your GAL appointment order that says...
Judge Morse said notifying people would not be a burden on the state and could speed up the application process for the benefits by reducing the amount of research the Social Security Administration needs to do before designating a payee. That would get the money to the kids faster. The state contracts with a private company for about $10,000 per year to apply for benefits on behalf of the children. Farzine also argued that using a child's federal benefits to pay for their time in foster care frees up more state money for all the kids.
When the state is the payee, all foster children get more resources.
But Judge Morse questioned if this is fair to the child who is entitled to the money.
The child loses money if the state is the payee when there could have been a private payee.
According to OCS, if the state spends less on a child's monthly care than it receives in benefits, it returns the extra money to the Social Security Administration. The SSA holds on to the funds until a new payee is assigned to the child. The judge has up to 6 months to issue a ruling. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a geoengineering plan to artificially freeze the Arctic.
It's been called James Bond villain-esque, or mad scientist.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're looking for ways to enhance your business knowledge about government contracting, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center statewide annual conference in Anchorage on March 8th. The PTAC conference presents a day of general sessions, learning labs, networking, and the popular Perfect Pitch competition. There will also be an opportunity to interact with representatives from government agencies. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced today he will not involve himself in any investigation of foreign interference in last year's election.
I have now decided to recuse myself from any existing or future investigations of any matter relating in any way to the campaigns for President of the United States.
Sessions was an advisor to the Trump campaign. He's now taking heat from members of Congress, mostly Democrats, over his failure to disclose during his confirmation hearing that he'd met twice with the Russian ambassador. Before Sessions announced his decision, Alaska's two U.S. senators took different positions. Senator Lisa Murkowski, through a spokeswoman, said earlier today Sessions should recuse himself and provide details on his meetings with the ambassador. Senator Dan Sullivan defended Sessions. A Sullivan press release blamed Democrats for trying to disparage the attorney general. The senator called it, quote, a politically motivated witch hunt. Sullivan served with Sessions on the Senate Armed Services Committee and said meeting ambassadors is part of the job. Sessions said today he did not recall any campaign-related discussion with the Russian ambassador. A group of U.S. senators, including one Alaskan, is asking the Justice Department to keep existing guidance on marijuana laws. The request came in a letter signed by Senator Lisa Murkowski, Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren, and nine other senators. They ask U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions to continue upholding what's called the Cole Memo. That's a 2013 document stating that federal officials will not take enforcement action in states that have opted to legalize and regulate cannabis. States like Alaska, Colorado, and Washington have looked to the Cole Memo for guidance in implementing recreational cannabis industries in recent years. The senator's letter says sensible drug policies can ensure that state infrastructure, including tax revenue, small businesses, and jobs, can be protected. Their letter comes just a week after White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer told reporters the public could expect to see greater enforcement of federal marijuana laws. That's at odds with statements made on the campaign trail by then-candidate Donald Trump, who said the issue should be determined by states. Murkowski was the only Republican to sign. Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan did not join the letter. But his spokesman says Sullivan thinks the federal government should defer to state law and the will of the voters on marijuana enforcement. Former Montana Congressman Ryan Zinke rode a horse to his first day of work in Washington, D.C. today. He's the new Secretary of the Interior. The position is an important one for Alaska, where more than 60% of the land is owned by the federal government. The Interior Secretary is also charged with upholding trust obligations to tribes. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she hopes that with the new secretary, she'll finally get approval for a road to connect King Cove to the all-weather airport in Cold Bay. Murkowski says Zinke seems sympathetic to the need for what she calls a life-saving road.
He has had not only an opportunity to be briefed on it many times, he's also met with some of the residents from King Cove, and he has indicated his understanding of the situation.
Zinke, though, would face fierce opposition from conservation groups who say the King Cove Road would damage the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge and important bird habitat. Soon after his swearing in, Zinke signed an order to reverse a last-minute Obama administration ban on lead ammunition and fishing tackle in national wildlife refuges. That made Alaska Congressman Don Young happy. Young said the lead ban, quote, had little to do with science and conservation and was instead one last parting gift to our nation's most extreme environmental elite. Steel shot and all copper bullets cost more than those with lead. Some sportsmen also say the non-lead ammunition shoots differently. Those who want to ban lead ammo argue the toxic metal contaminates waterways, wildlife, and people who eat game meat. The question has been looming since December. Will Haines lose its only Alaska State Trooper? The final answer is yes. The division chief says amid a shrinking budget, Haines' level of crime isn't great enough to maintain the local trooper post. Instead, funding for the Haines position will be moved to the Violent Offenders Unit in Bethel. KHNS's Emily Files reports.
It is final.
Colonel James Cockrell is director of the Alaska State Troopers. He says his budget has been cut by millions of dollars in the past 2 years, and more reductions may be coming. But even if the budget were to stay status quo, Cockrell says they'd still move the Haines position to Bethel.
We don't have the luxury of putting them in communities that doesn't have the amount of level of crime that some of our other ones do, where we're really struggling to keep up. If you look out in western Alaska, where we're struggling to keep up with the numbers of sexual assaults and sexual abuse of minor cases in those areas where we're doing felony level investigations, I mean, when you look at the total need of the people of the state, certainly it doesn't support having a position in Haines when we need it elsewhere in the state.
Haines' single blue shirt trooper patrolled and responded to calls outside of the town site. That includes neighborhoods out the Haines Highway, Mud Bay Road, and Lutac Road. Cockrell says the state feels that the Haines Police Department should take over as the primary law enforcement agency for the entire borough.
The Haines Police Department should patrol inside the Haines borough.
Haines isn't the first community in which AST has tried to shift law enforcement responsibility to police departments. The same thing happened in Girdwood.
We need to address how we are going to operate outside the roadway.
That's Haines Police Chief Heath Scott. His department works primarily in the town site, but since the trooper post has been vacant the past couple months, it's fallen to the police to respond to emergency calls in the outer borough. Scott says that costs money that the borough has not budgeted.
The longer we don't resolve this matter, the longer this unfunded requirement causes a burden to us.
The police department is already more than $30,000 over budget for the first half of the current fiscal year. The chief and interim manager say much of the overspending comes down to overtime. Scott says the department is stretched too thin. He's advocating for the borough to hire a fifth police officer. Borough officials have talked about asking the state for reimbursement to cover expenses the police department incurs when responding to calls that previously would have been handled by the trooper. Cockrell says he's not sure if that's possible.
They can give us a ballpark figure of what they're looking for, but at the same token, again, the state's position is the borough's responsibility.
How the borough will pay for this new responsibility remains to be seen. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical cost. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Lawmakers will take their first look on Friday at a bill changing the Alaska State Council on the Arts from an agency to a public corporation. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Arts Council Executive Director Andrea Noble-Pallant says it would allow for more partnerships and funding opportunities.
Our choice is we can stay the same and watch our organization dwindle or be less effective, or we can take a step to become more efficient.
Senate Bill 66 and House Bill 137 call for the change. The switch to a public corporation would result in a number of operational adjustments. One would remove the council from requirements of the state procurement code. Juno's Ben Brown, who chairs the Arts Council's board, says it's a necessary change.
The procurement code is, you know, something to make sure that state agencies operate in a certain manner. But we're a little bit different than some other state agencies in some of the programs and services that we are trying to provide. And we're certainly different in having funding available to us from private foundation partners.
The council's budget for this year is about $2.8 million. About a quarter comes from the state, matched by a quarter from the federal government. The other half comes from foundations and other private donors. Brown says the legislation was proposed by the council after an extensive operational review. Another section of the bills would exempt artist submissions to the council from public records laws. Noble-Pallant says information about accepted commissions would remain public. She says the bill removes those from artists whose proposals are not accepted.
Artists are business people, and they are part of that creative economy. They are often sole proprietors, and when they apply for a commission, it's much like someone who's applying for a job.
The bills would keep the State Arts Council within the Department of Education, but the legislation changes board requirements from having interest in the arts to having expertise. Brown says that's important.
Hopefully all Alaskans have interest in the arts. You know, that's one of the reasons the council exists. But I don't know that it's fair to say that as many Alaskans have expertise in the arts. And to be a member of the council, it's appropriate that people have more than just, I think, a passing interest, but have some level of expertise, whatever that may be.
Noble-Pallant says the change could expand the pool of applicants to administrators and others who are not necessarily artists themselves. Under the bills, the board's 11 members would automatically become trustees for the new corporation, and members would continue to be appointed by the governor. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
The Arctic could see its first ice-free summer as soon as 2030, as the region continues to warm faster than the rest of the planet. Some scientists think we've reached the point where no amount of reducing carbon emissions will save the Arctic, and a small group of scientists think it's time for an intervention to help Mother Nature out. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Jennifer Pemberton has the story.
Douglas McMartin at Cornell University works in a field called geoengineering, which sounds like a branch of geology or something, but it's a little more out there than that.
Any really large-scale project that's designed to intentionally deal with some of the consequences of climate change.
Large-scale projects like manipulating ocean currents with heat pumps or spraying reflective particles into the troposphere to reflect solar radiation back into space. Sci-fi stuff. But with math to back it up. Steve Desch at Arizona State University recently published a paper describing his geoengineering idea, placing seawater pumps in the Arctic that would assist nature in making ice.
What we're proposing doing is helping the ice freeze over an area of about 10% of the Arctic.
Desch is an astrophysicist.
It's not what you expected, is it?
He mostly studies the climates of other planets and moons, especially the really icy ones. But he found himself at more and more conferences with scientists focused on planet Earth.
I came away thinking that, the problem is very urgent, but I didn't feel like they were addressing solutions other than stop making CO2. And that's when I decided to contribute something.
The motivation behind Desch's recent paper is that reducing carbon emissions from our cars and our factories and homes is not enough to reverse global warming. Basically, desperate times called for proactive and potentially costly engineering measures. DESH's plan would require 10 million wind-powered pumps spread out across the sea. They would create a meter of sea ice across 10% of the Arctic. It's a lot, but not impossible.
It's a number that is big. It sounds like a ridiculous number at first. On the other hand, we make 10 million automobiles in this country every year.
Made of steel, each pump would cost around $50,000 to manufacture. The total price tag would be somewhere around $500 billion. DESH says that amount is comparable to the Manhattan Project or the Iraq War.
It's been called James Bond villain-esque or mad scientist, and we don't know what all the consequences are going to be, but they are figure-outable.
The plan may be grandiose, but the idea itself is relatively simple, relatively natural as far as geoengineering projects go. Even Doug McMartin, the engineer, thinks it's an elegant solution.
I grew up in Ottawa, where every winter they flood the canal with ice. If it's going to be a cold night, they just pump water on top of the ice to make it thicker so you can go skate on the canal. So I've always sort of thought, hey, why can't we just go do that in the Arctic?
Even if you think of geoengineering as a last resort, scientists like McMartin don't want people to stop trying to reduce carbon emissions.
It seems hard to imagine why one would consider some of the more radical solutions if we hadn't taken the first steps to actually cut our carbon emissions.
Anchorage-based climatologist Brian Brettschneider thinks geoengineering projects are starting to sound less crazy than they did a few years ago.
I'm still kind of an optimist that we can do kind of some dramatic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, but maybe we can't. And at that point, you know, at what point do you say, you know, now we're in emergency mode? Maybe we're there. I don't know.
One thing's for sure. If and when we can agree that we're there, the geoengineers will be ready. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and Jennifer Pemberton in Juneau, Emily Files and Haynes, and Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Seward Peninsula Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Nome March 6th and 7th at the Mini Convention Center from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.